The talk that you are about to listen to was given by George Wilmot. George Wilmot, when on Earth, was a rag and bone merchant. And you will find what he has to say is very interesting. But let me warn you, there are one or two words which he uses that are not usually used when we speak today.
My name's Wilmot, George Wilmot.
George
Wilmot? Yeah,
I've been
around here several times listening to conversations and I thought perhaps one day I might get a look in, you know, never know your luck. But that Dr. Marshall fella, he's a real gent, you know, really is. He knows his onions, says that man.
Of course he does.
Yeah. He certainly knows his onions, all right.
Mr. Wilmot, can you tell us, you know, about yourself?
I was a rag and bone merchant. Yeah, you know, I used to go around the houses collecting up whatever they got, you know, make a little bit on it. I sort of eked out an existence, I suppose you'd call it a living. Occasionally I'd have a good day and I'd get something really good, worthwhile, and get a fiver for it probably, you know.
Yeah.
But I never was that lucky as some of them right now. Of course, a lot of that's talk, but anyway, I'm quite happy to be out of your world. I had enough on it one way and another. I had a pretty rough time taking it by and large.
Mm-hmm.
Although in my own way I enjoyed myself, I had a bit of fun at times. I had two wives, neither of them any bloody good, still. Perhaps it's as much of me as them, who knows. But I was unlucky, I suppose.
Mr. Wilmot, how did you come through the
hospital? Oh, I caught pneumonia. One bad winter, going round, you know. Got a bit of a cough and chest trouble started up. And before I knew, I was in the local hospital, you know. One there more than about a week. That was too far gone, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'd always had a bit of a cough and that my chest was always a bit of a weak. But, dear, you know, I may make you laugh, but it's perfectly true. Mind you, I was always fond of people. I always took an interest in people. As a matter of fact, I think I can say this with honesty, that often people will come and ask me proper questions if they're in trouble. It's always glad to help people, but fond of people. But the odd thing was, and in a way I'm not surprised because I was so fond of her, but my old Jenny was the one that I first saw when I come in.
Oh.
Yeah, nah, that's got you guessing. But Jenny wasn't neither of my wives, thank God. It was my horse.
Oh,
yeah, she was old Jenny. She used to pull my cart when in my earlier years in the 30s, you know. I was real upset when poor old Jenny collapsed and died, you know. She was as near to me as any woman could be. In fact, more so, I had great affection and regard for old Jenny, and she knew everything that I ever said to her. I'm sure she did. She was as cute as that cat. She was a real beaut. She wasn't much to look at, I suppose, as horses go, of course, but she was a real nice old nag, she was. And the first thing I remember when I woke up over here was being in a, well, I suppose you'd call it a field. I seemed to be sitting lying under a tree, and I remember sort of waking up, and I could see this horse coming towards me. And there was my old Jenny. God, she looked younger, of course, and she was, oh, she was so thrilled and so happy. You could sense and feel it. I can't say how. I mean, this is something I can't explain. But it's almost as if she was talking to me. It was extraordinary. I couldn't hear any voice, and you don't expect to hear a horse speak. But it was somehow mentally, I suppose, now I realise it must have been as if she was speaking to me and welcoming me. And she came and stood beside me and was licking my face. Goodness me, I never forget this as long as I live. And I was so thrilled, so excited. And I was patting her and fussing her, and then it was as if I heard a voice behind me, and I turned round, and there was a fine-looking chap. She was about 6'2", tall, fair-haired, young, and he was such a nice fella. And he says, "I've come to look after you." So I says, "Come look after me, what are you talking about?" You know, I sort of so taken back, what with Jenny and the rest of it. He says, "Yeah, I'm going to look after you." He says, "I've been in charge of you." I said, "What do you mean in charge of me? I'm always capable of looking after myself. Always had to anyway." He says, "No, you don't understand." He says, "You know you're dead." Because for the moment it struck me like a thunderbolt, you know.
And it suddenly came to me, of course, Jenny had been dead some years and I'd had an own old nag after her, you see. Nice horse, but never to me like Jenny. So he says, is your dead? And I thought, well, I don't know what to make of this now. Then it seemed as if he was able to show me something. I don't know whether he showed it to me, I suppose he did. But I could see myself lying in a bed, stiff and stark, you know. And it's as if, well, it was as if I was looking at my own body, and yet I wasn't there, and yet I was there. And I saw them put this body on a trolley, take it out of the bed, put it on a trolley, and wheel it away. And I was walking behind this body being wheeled out, and then it all disappeared. And I was back where I was with this rope, and I found out afterwards his name was Michael. So I said, he said, my name is Michael. So I said, oh, yes. So he says, Julian, I should dead. So I said, well, I don't know what to think. He says, well, you just had that realization, didn't you, that vision light of your body light. He says, you know, you died in that hospital. So I said, well, I recollect now I was very ill in hospital, but if this, how can I be dead when I'm here and I'm talking to you and I've got Jenny? He says, well, isn't Jenny in itself some evidence to you you're dead? So I said, well, it seems very strange. And then again, I said, if I'm in heaven, if that's it, I said, you know, it's better to find horses there. I said, they ain't got no souls, are they? So he said, ah, that's what they tell you on the earth. He says that they ain't got no sort of other life, only just a whole material life, as you call it, like, you know. So he says that horse, because of its nearness to you and the love and affection you've showered on it, has given it something which helps it to extend, as he put it, its lifespan. I didn't quite get all this luck, you know, extended lifespan and all this. He said, but while you have love and affection and regard for that horse will have an existence. He says, human beings don't know their responsibility, he says, to animals. He says, ever since I've been here, which is hundreds of years, because I looked at him when he said that, I thought, well, this is a bit much, you know, looking so young and spruce and nice, looking hundreds of years. I thought, but anyway, I thought, well, don't do to interrupt these gentlemen. I, you know, after all, I felt a bit lost, and I thought I had a mind with Q's and P's, you know. So he says, oh, he says, time is nothing, you see, so I said, Emily, you know, it's nothing, mate, you know. So he says, I've been here for hundreds of years, he says, and part of my responsibility and my job, as he put it, is to see and care for animals. He says, I often go down into the pits. I wonder what the hell he meant when he said pits. I thought he meant the hell or something. So he says, no, he says, pits, where they have the animals down in the mines. He says, I tend to them and try to help them, but he says, it's not a great deal you can do. He says, a lot of them are very badly treated, you know. He says, over here we have great plains, that's what he put it like, places where animals congregate and where there's love and affection and they can be cared for. He says, people have this stupid idea, he says, that because they're human beings, they're the only ones that have got any right to a future existence. Should there be one, because a lot of people on earth, he says, don't believe there is one. He says, then you get the religious ones who think there must be and there is, but they haven't got much of a conception of it either. Of course, he was talking a lot of stuff here, you know, and I was getting very intrigued, and I thought, all the time he was talking, I was half listening, half thinking about myself, what I was going to do, you know, being dead and all the rest of it. It was as if he was illustrating things. I was trying to take it in. At the same time, I couldn't stop thinking about myself and my own worries. Anyway, he says, you don't want to sit here. He says, let's walk. So I says, all right. So I thought, well, this seems so odd. Anyway, I walked beside him. We walked through this field into what appeared to be a sort of road through a little gate. It was just, honestly, it was just as if he was in the country on earth, you know. And as I was walking along, the horse followed me. I thought, well, I don't know, it seems so strange, it's horse following me. I mean, yeah, I was so fond of it, and there was no doubt about it, it was the same horse that I'd had before. But anyway, I thought, well, don't need to worry too much, you know, I never was really the worrying kind. So I walked beside him, and we walked and walked, so it seemed to me, and everything was so pretty and beautiful. There were flowers growing by the wayside, and there was this very attractive sort of road, not very wide, very narrow, really. I suppose you could have got a awesome cart along there. It's about all been jumped for two to par, one to pass another. But anyway, we walked into this country place and past little houses, and I could see people sometimes standing at the door, and sometimes they'd be looking out the window, and they all seemed so bright and yet very normal, very natural. Sometimes they would wave, and sometimes people would call out, and they all seemed to be white people. I didn't see any coloured people, and I thought to myself, this must be, if it's what he says it is, heaven and that, it must be a white people's heaven. I started thinking about coloured people. I don't know why I was thinking about coloured people. I thought, well, I don't know, and it all seemed to be quite normal and natural here, but I didn't see any other people, only white people. So I wondered to myself, because I didn't say anything to him, but he must have been able to read my thoughts. Ah, he says, you wonder why it is that these people are all white people. So he says, all coloured people too, all races, all nations. But he said, of course, it's natural. He says that people want to live in a community or a condition of life which is best suited to them. I mean, they like, perhaps a person likes a little cottage and they're quite happy to live in that way, and they have that, whereas perhaps a coloured person, depending on his experience of life and so on, wouldn't be happy in what you would call a white man's sort of atmosphere. Anyway, he says, you'll find there are people of all nations, all types here. And he says, they live in a community or condition of life, he says, that's best suited to them, to which they'd be most happy. But gradually, he says, they change their thoughts and their outlooks, whether it's white or coloured. He says, and they then find communities where they're into whatever it is, get together, you know. So I thought, I don't know, his spoke seems to know all the answers. He seems to be able to even read my thoughts, so I have to be careful what I think. He said, he looked at me as I was thinking this, and he smiled. He says, you don't have to think like that. He says, just be yourself. I quite understand whatever your thoughts are. I thought, well, I don't know, he's a nice fellow, but he had to be, you know, careful here. But he seemed very humorous, which struck me as odd, because I always thought religious people would be very sort of highfalutin and sort of, you know, well, rather dour, you know, like sort of hard to get on with and rather religious. And anyway, he seemed quite normal, quite natural. I felt quite happy with him, really. And anyway, we went along and we went through what seemed to be a side turning, and then we veered to the right past a lot of poplar trees on each side of the road, very pretty. And I thought, these poplar trees, they remind me of something, I can't think of what, you know. And then all of a sudden it came to me, of course I remember, and I remember this road. It was exactly the same as the road in France when I was there in the 1418 war, these lovely big tall trees aside there. And I knew that before I even reached it, that the far end of this would be a very old house, and it would be full of people that I'd known. I don't know why I thought this when, after all, it was all new experience, but if it was going to turn out like I thought it was going to be these people that were so nice to me when I was in France, when I was billeted. Anyway, it turned out that it was, and there was this mother and daughter there and the father, but they came us to the end of the road and the edge of the gate there, looking over, waving like mad at me. And I thought to myself, well, I don't know, These people, I believe they must have been killed, because I'd heard a little later that this place had been absolutely bombed, you know, during the war, and I couldn't get this out of my mind. I thought, well, these people, I got a feeling that they were dead anyway, and I thought, well, I'm dead, and I'm supposed to be in a dead man's world, so these people must be dead. All this is going on in my mind, and then I looked at them in hard, you know, and I could see that the husband and the wife looked young. They were the same people, but they looked younger. Then my mind went to two pictures that they used to have over a sideboard. One was of her and one was of him when they were young. Ooh, I suppose they would have been then in their 20s. And they looked exactly like they looked in them, their two portraits that they had. She looked exactly the same, so did he. And the daughter, she looked as young as the mother. Mother, you know, she looked about the same age. Of course, this daughter I was very drawn and attached to. And actually, if things had gone right, I would, well, given the opportunity, I would have proposed to her, because I wasn't married then, you see. And I always think that, because I know now, but I always was on earth. That's one other reason why perhaps my two marriages didn't work out. I always carried this girl's memory in my heart, you know. I always think what a nice little thing she was, and she was very sweet and kind, and I always felt she was the right one for me, although we could hardly speak a word of each other's lingo. I mean, but we seemed to get on. They were always very good to me. But I heard, as I told you, that the whole place around that area had been very badly bombed, and, you know, I think I didn't know for sure, mind you, whether they'd been killed, and I realise now, of course, then, that they must have been. Anyway, they were chatting away, and the funny thing was, the first time in life I could understand their lingo.
Oh, yeah.
You see, when on earth, I mean, I could, they spoke just a little bit of English, at least the old boy did, and the mother could say a few words, but here they were chatting away to me, or at least so it seemed to me, but I understood everything perfectly. And they were holding conversation, and I was holding conversation, and anyway, I got inside this place, and there it was exactly the same. The room was the same, the chairs, the sideboard was there, the two pictures was there, the lamp was standing on the side where I always remember it. Oh, it was, well, it was fantastic. And there I was. Well, I couldn't get over this. So this young fella said to me, well, now, he says, I'm going to leave you with your friends. He said, but I shall come back in a little while, and we will talk about what we're going to do and what you would like to do. After all, it's important that you should do what you want to do, not for me to say what you must do, because in any case, he says, I can't tell you what you must do. No one here evidently ever tells you what you've got to do. They may make suggestions and give you ideas, but everyone seems to be so free and easy and be able to do the things they want to do within reason, you say. And anyway, I was quite happy, I suppose, because now I realise that I was taken to these people because, well, he knew that I had this sort of deep regard and affection for the family and the girl, and I suppose he knew that I'd be happier with them. I realised since, of course, he was right. Anyway, I stayed with him, and it struck me as so odd, you know. And I always remember another thing. It was difficult, of course, at that time about food and one thing the other one on earth, I mean. And they always used to make some soup. I don't quite know how they made it, because things were tough. But I suppose, of course, being farm and all that, or at least farm property, they always seemed to rake up something the press you couldn't get anywhere else. Anyway, they... I don't know why, I didn't even want it, I suppose, in a way, and yet in a subconscious sort of way, I suppose, I sort of associated with them, and they said, oh, we've got something nice for you that you'll enjoy, and I thought, food, well, don't eat food in heaven, do you? So they laughed, you know, and anyway, they put this big bowl of soup in front of me, and honestly, it's just as if I was on earth again, back in time, you know, and I was having this soup, and I enjoyed it. And the smoke too, the old boy had his pipe, because he was an old boy now, but it was just like old times, and yet there was a difference. Because this went on, I stayed there, I don't know how long, I had no idea of time with us. And then this fair boy came back again, he said, well, he said, how do you feel? So I says, I feel fine. I said, I never felt better. So I said to him, I said, what amazes me is the naturalness of everything, being able to eat and drink and smoke and all the rest of it. He looked at me and he laughed. He says, well, he said, that is only because you think, and other people like you think, those things are necessary. He says, but you'll soon realise they're not. And then when the desire goes, the thought force or whatever it is you call it, he says, will disappear with it, and those things will no longer exist for you. Things only exist for you until such time as you decide that they're not necessary. So he said, did you find your horse being cared for? Of course, they brought back my memory of that. I said, oh, yes, I've been round, and I got a stable round the back, and the horse is well fed and well looked after, and he goes out in the fields every day, he says. And he says, you're quite happy about that, then. So he says, you're quite happy here. So I said, oh, yes, I don't particularly want to move, but I'm quite happy. I said, but I am a bit curious. So he says, what do you mean, curious? About what? So he says, about my two wives, Emmy and Liz. So he says, oh, do you want to go and see them? So I says, well, we didn't get it off, you know. Liz had another bloke, you know. And I said, no, not really. So he says, I believe you would really like to know what happened to them. So I says, well, yes and no, I don't want to meet them. So he says, you don't have to meet them if you don't want to. He says, but you can go and see them, and they won't see you. I thought, well, this is a bit, you know, much. So he says, well, what do you want to do? He says, you can go and see them. So I says, all right. So, because I didn't know this either, because I lost touch. You know, I mean, I went my own way, and they went off, and they had their own interests and affairs. And so I said, I don't know if they're dead or alive. He says, well, as a matter of fact, they're both alive, but they're both very old now. And one lives in the country, and the other one lives in London. So I says, oh. So I said, I don't think I'll bother. So he says, look, he says, I think you should. So I says, well, I said, we never got on. I said, I don't really feel inclined. So he says, I think you should. He says, because one of them will be coming over in a matter of, well, a very short time, and I think it'll be a help. I couldn't see how I could help her, because we never get it off at all. So anyway, cut a long story short. He said, I went with him. Now, it's funny that when you talk about going with someone from this side, because you don't get on the train, you don't get on a bus, you don't get no Green Line buses and that sort of luck, you know. So I said, well, how do we go? Oh, he says, we go. He says, just completely relax. He says, don't think of anything. Just completely relax. And just leave it to me. So I didn't quite know what to do. He says, oh, just close your eyes. Don't think of anything. And before I knew where I was, it was as if I was sort of transported. I suppose like in a pantomime, you know, they have these transformation scenes. Anyway, that long story short, I found myself in an house in a, walking up a street. At least it seems as if I was walking up a street. A very old place it was, a lot of houses all much the same. And I found myself in a room, real old-fashioned Victorian house it was. And there was my old girl lying on an arm bedstead. Oh, she didn't have a lot of sight. I suppose I shouldn't have thought this. I thought, my God, I've been spared or something. You know, I thought, well, that's wrong to think like that. But she never was all that good looking. But anyway, she looked ghastly, and I thought, oh, blimey. So this fella says, Michael, he says, you know, she's coming over here soon. So I said, you did tell me that. So he said, I don't think she'll recognise you. I don't think she'll see you. Because it's very rare, he says, that they do see us. They're completely sort of blind to us for some reason, he says, and partly due to the fact they just don't understand that there is a possibility of, you know, this sort of thing, communication and that. He says, but just stand at the foot of the bed, will you? And concentrate on her. So I said, well, why should I do that? I'm not all that interested. He said, look, he says, you've got to learn. He says that even though you don't get on with people and you don't love people particularly, that in some senses you have duty to perform and it'll help her. So I said, all right. So I stood as he said. And then all of a sudden I could see her sort of change colour, is any way I can put it. She seemed as if the colour came back to her cheeks and her eyes were brighter and she looked quite different. And I heard her call out my name, you see. It made me feel right funny inside, I tell you. I felt real jolly, you know, standing there like that. And anyway, she sort of put her hands out. And then all of a sudden, I could see that she'd changed, you know, something had happened. And there was a light round her, all bright light there was. And then I saw other people standing around, come in the room, standing around. Oh, and I could see one or two of these people that, although I wasn't exactly, you might say, exactly on the same wavelength or whatever you like to call it with them, I could see them clearly enough, and I recognised two of them as being her mother and father. And, she seemed to float, as any way I can put it, as if she floated above her body and came to a sort of, well, as if she sort of lifted herself up straight up. And I'm, matter of fact, it sounds stupid now, but I backed out of the way, thought she was going to fall right on top of me. And Michael whispered to me, he said, she's coming out of her body now, she's going to be all right, they're going to take her away. You see, that's her mother and father, and there's other people, her friends that have come to help. He said, I just wanted you to come, because in a way you've helped her, you don't realise yet how much you've helped her. So I said, well, it's very odd. I said, she's all alone here. So he said, yes, she's only been living alone for many years, and there's no one bothers much about her. And the other people in the house don't even know she's in bed. They'll find her dead in bed probably sometime during the day or perhaps tomorrow. He said, well, that's not so important. It's to help her over a difficult time. She's had a rough time, you know, since you know her. And the man she went to live with, he packed up and left. And well, she's gone from bad to worse. He says, she needs help. And although you don't realise it, she was very fond of you in a way. So I said, well, I wouldn't have thought so, the way she behaved. I said, look, you mustn't think like that. And, oh, he's giving me advice, and he was doing this and doing that. Anyway, it was all very interesting. At the same time, I thought, well, perhaps I ought to try and do something, but what could I do? I mean, I was new myself to all this business. Anyway, he said, no, I want you to go and see your other wife. Oh, blimey, I said, must we? So he said, yes, come on. So the next thing I knew was that I was in some sort of a country pub. At least where it was a pub, all right, but like an inn or something, real old country place. And there she was, called, blimey, you'd have seen her. You'd have said to yourself, like I said inwardly, oh, look what I've been saved from, you know, she looked ghastly. Her hair was all dyed, proper colour. You know, her hair when she was young was a sort of auburn colour. Well, she'd obviously gone grey, and she dyed it a red colour, called, blimey, she looked like a bloody scarecrow. She was sitting there knocking the gin back, you know. she looked a proper old sow. So he says, look at the state she's in. And then Michael said to me, we must try and help her. She's gone from bad to worse, and really she's in a shocking state. So I said, well, I don't know what we can do for her. I said, I really, quite frankly, her drink was, I knew drink was going to be the ruination of her. She couldn't half knock it back. He said, well, yes. But even so, he says, we've got to try and help her. So I said, well, I don't know what I could do. I tried my best when I was on Earth, but I couldn't stomach her for all that length of time. I had to do something. So he said, I'm not interested in the past. He says, well, I'm interested in the future. He says, we've got to try and save her, try and help her, you know. So I said, oh, well, I don't know. What could I do? He says, you can. So he says, what I want you to do is to stay with her. I says, what, you're going to, you know, mate, you know, I don't stay with her. I'm happy where I am with my French friends, and, you know, I just don't want to come. He says, look, he says, I want you to do one thing for me. He says, I want you to stay with her for a few weeks. He says, and try and concentrate your thought that she will become different, that things will change, you know, that she will think differently and act differently. So I thought, well, this is a proper child, you know, me. Cool. I said, no, I couldn't do that. He says, look, he says, admittedly, he says, it's no good you trying to do it if you don't want to. And if you have that negative, as he calls it, thought, he says, no good will come of it. But you could help her, because, well, probably you're the only person who can help her. He says, you haven't long been over here. You're still close enough to the earth to be able to really sort of tune in, as he called it, to her, and help her with her thoughts. So I said, well, I don't know what I can do. He says, well, try it, mate, try it. So I thought, all right, I'll try it. Try it once, but I wasn't happy about it. I said, what about my French friends? I think I've deserted them. He says, they understand. They know. They know you're coming here to do a job. I said, me, do a job? What with her? So he says, yes, you've got to do a job with her, because it's your duty. I said, duty? I ain't got no duty. He says, you'll find your hair. Anyway, I stayed with her for about, I don't know, must have been some weeks. And I didn't like it at all. Night after night, sitting in this bar, she was knocking them back, picking up feathers. Not that anyone really had much to do with her. I mean, she was as ugly as, I don't know what. She looked, I don't know, all that makeup and muck she'd got on, you know. But, I don't know, I didn't seem to be able to get anywhere with her at all at first. And then one day, she thought she had a dream. And she thought she saw me in the dream. Actually, it was that she was able to leave her body. And I must say this, when she left her body, she did look different, thank God. And she tried.
You made a dream?
Try and bring him back next time to continue. Oh. So sorry, power seems to have gone.
All right, Dr. Marshall.
I'm so sorry about
that. It's quite all right, Dr. Marshall.
George Wilmot spoke for as long as the power lasted. And I hope that you have enjoyed this recording. Listen now to a direct voice talk given by Brother Boniface in another seance.
Bless you, my children.
Bless
Hello,
you,
Brother Boniface.
I was listening to your conversation, and I particularly was interested in the last remark or so, particularly in regard to the word practical. When everyone refers to material things, invariably the word practical is applied or used. One has to be practical. One has to be sensible. One has to consider the material aspects of life and so on and so on. And one finds particularly with those who become interested in this truth, in this great subject which is so dear to us all, whenever you discuss it with people, or quite often when you discuss it with people, they say, oh yes, it's all very wonderful, very interesting, but you must be practical. Very few people in your world ever assume that spiritual awareness, spiritual consciousness, and spiritual communication, that all these things that apply to the mind and the spirit, are necessarily practical. Always people have this idea that this subject is not really practical. Either practical from application in the material world or practical in its spiritual realization. So many arguments are put forward. So many people, when they are interested indeed in this truth and allow themselves to study it, go into it, and become sometimes even workers in this great truth. Quite often, they feel that they must be practical. They must, as it were, keep their feet on the ground, even though their head may be in the clouds. Constantly, throughout generations of time, prophets and seers, teachers, visionaries, messiahs, call them what you will, all these varying souls of different degree who've been anxious to bring to the world illumination of the spirit have been referred to as impractical, been referred to as individuals who are not able to adjust themselves to material thoughts and ideas. In other words, they are most impractical and are invariably shunned, or if they are listened to and in some instances accepted, the average person particularly will have little or nothing to do with them. Or if they do, as I say, they feel they must be sensible and practical. They don't want to make any sacrifices of any material nature. And if they do, as so often one finds when an individual is inclined to make any material sacrifice, they want to know what they're going to get for it. In other words, what I'm trying to convey here is our concern about the impracticability of man when he takes an interest in this great truth. Very few are they who are prepared to go full out, as it were, in endeavouring to do the will and the work of the Spirit. They will go so far with you. They will perhaps go further than they intended. And then all of a sudden, they will be faced with this fact as they consider it of being practical. I think we must be fully conscious and aware of the fact that if we are going to do the work of the Spirit in the fullest sense, we cannot afford to make within ourselves agreements. We cannot put ourselves in the position where we will say, yes, we'll do so much and no more. We cannot sort of place ourselves in an attitude of mind where we will decide that we shall go so far and no further, or that we shall do so much and no more. In other words, so many people repeatedly say we must be balanced. I doubt very much, really, if people know what they mean when they talk about being balanced. Because truly and surely, the more you know of the things and the ways of the Spirit, the more you know of the reality of the power of the Spirit, the more you are conscious of the eternal truth of Spirit, the more you realize the importance of a material life and how you yourself must adjust your thinking and your action in consequence concerning it. The vast majority of people who enter into this knowledge, they are prepared to accept it, providing it does not too much interfere with their own material life. As soon as you start making any sacrifices, as soon as you start doing anything which will label you in the eyes of others as a crank or as an odd person, you can be sure that you are on the road of spiritual progress. It may become comfort in a sense to some, because I can hear so many people say, oh dear, how stupid can people be? They say that they are spiritually conscious and aware of truth, and they wish to propagate it. And they are going to place themselves in such a beggarly condition that they won't be in a position to even eat. And then, of course, they will come on to us for help. Constantly we hear these things being thrown up as it were, a weapon against us. A weapon against people doing things which are not in the usual run of generally accepted traits and conditions of life. What we want so much is for people to have such faith and such realization of the power within them to overcome and to achieve and to do the will of the Most High and the things that are truly the Spirit, that they will have no fear and they will have no doubts within themselves that they shall be looked after, they shall be provided for, they shall be guided. Christ said to the disciples and to others, "Give up all that thou hast to the poor and follow me." And of course there will be those who say, "Yes, and look what happened to those that followed him. They lived very uncertain lives from day to day, not knowing from whence the next meal would come. And look how some of them ended their lives." We cannot be like that. We cannot do this, we cannot do that. How little faith have they? "I say unto you," as Christ said unto his disciples, "give up all that thou hast and follow the truth as you know it to be." Realizing that you are truly surrounded by innumerable souls whose power and whose love is great and who will provide for you according to your needs and who will instill in you such a power that it shall truly remove mountains. Christ himself said, "Greater things than these shall he do, for I go unto my Father." And how true is that indeed, that if the faith were such, there would be little or nothing that would be impossible by that faith, if it were a good thing to do or to achieve. And this, I think, is important. So many people assume that if they need something, or if they want something, that it must be good for them to have it or to receive it, particularly if they are following the path of spirit and of truth as they've been guided and advised to do. But it is not necessarily so, that some of the things that you may feel are so vital and important, not only to the advancement of the work that you are doing, but to the advancement of others near and dear to you and others that you are endeavouring to help, that certain things should transpire because you feel that they are necessary. It's very difficult to have such faith that within yourself you know that those things that are good for you to have will be presented to you in some shape or form at some given time when you yourself have made it possible, in conjunction with those who work with you on this side, bringing it into being. So often people ask for things, and truly they believe them to be of a spiritual nature, and not even for self. And they are surprised when perhaps those things do not come into being, or do not appear that they are likely to come into being. And they are puzzled and they wonder why. Often we hear people saying, "I am a good Christian. I follow the teachings of Christ. I endeavor in all things to do unto others as that I would be done by. I endeavor to do all that I would that is good. And yet, whatever I touch seems to bear little fruit. I do not seem to make any progress." How often we hear the cry from your world of people who in sincerity endeavor as they do to do all that is good and seem to achieve so little. I can only say that in answer to this, that there are reasons why sometimes things do not transpire in the way in which one would wish. And perhaps it is that these things are withheld for a time, because that moment is not yet ripe, when you perhaps yourself are ready to achieve or to do this or that, even though it be of the Spirit, the work which you strive to do. There are to some in your world many complexities concerning this work. And constantly, as I've said, we hear people say, you must keep a level head, you must keep your feet on the ground. I wonder if they really know what they mean. Of course, we in this world are not unaware of your problems. We are not unaware of the difficulties of your lives. Indeed, we are more conscious and more aware than you give us credit for, and perhaps it is that we know more in certain senses, even concerning material things, than you yourselves know. And we never ask any soul to do anything that is not within their capability and power. But it is important to think and to realize that we are not impractical. We are highly practical because we know that the power in the material world, and I speak now not of the power that is known to you, not the material power that is generally accepted and used, but the power within the material world, which is of a psychic nature, and indeed, in a sense, a spiritual origin, which, if properly understood and used and applied, can make all things that are good possible. We are practical inasmuch that we know that within every human being there is a force and a power which, if they use it right, will draw to them all that is good. And it is a practical force, not an impractical one. And it is true to say that human beings, while yet on earth, if they have that faith and that realization of the power within themselves and all around and about them, the vitality that can be brought forth and used in so many different ways is the most practical thing in human life. Much that happens to men that seems on the surface to occur miraculously, or as it were, in an unusual sense or an unexpected way, is because of certain forces around and about the individual which make this possible. All sorts of things which you refer to often as coincidence and strange and odd and the various terms that you give them, these things do not happen in a haphazard necessarily manner. They happen because of planning and organization. They happen because we often on this side, using a power which we know of, makes possible certain things for your good and for your benefit. We are most practical. We are often accused of making you impractical when you become interested in the things of the mind and of the spirit. Often, not only in this truth as you know it, but in other religious bodies and organizations in your world, there are many men who live most impractically. And yet, in a sense, it is because in their foolishness and their ignorance they have not found the true course or the true way of life. I do not come, as I've said to you so often, to denounce. I do not come to condemn. I do not come in any way to cast doubts or fears upon others or their beliefs. I come only to speak truth and to show you where possible the path that you may tread it. And if there is error, I may come as I do to point out error, but never do I, or any soul like unto me, come to your world to condemn. But it is important to realize that we come to you as beings who are most rational, who are most practical, even when we are dealing with what you term material thoughts and things and ideas, and how these things may work or apply to you as individuals. We do not come to you and say, do this or to do that, without first we consider it in every sense. We do not ask you to be foolish, but we do ask you to use the intelligence that you have, at the same time realizing that the power of the spirit that is within you has the power to make manifest in and around and about you such conditions that you yourself will see the wisdom and the path that you must follow. We come to point a way, we come to guide you, but we can only guide you so far, because you yourselves to some extent limit that guidance that we can give. But as you open your minds to perceive it, so we can as it were, lead you further on and show you more of that path that we have planned. But you must tread it. We do not expect that everything shall be easy. We do not expect that everything shall come necessarily as you may wish it, or even we. But we always know this one thing, that nothing is impossible, that all things that are good are possible. If the individual has that faith within themselves and will make every effort of their own, you must not expect that a thing shall happen just because you wish it, or because you know of us and that we come to you with power and with love to help you, that it will necessarily come just because of these things. You also must make effort. You also must do your part and your share. But also those around and about you who likewise have become interested in this great truth and knowing what it can achieve and do must in themselves make an effort. They must not say, oh, this is not practical. They must realize that the word of the spirit and the mind and the spirit and all that we do in spirit and in truth is possible. Nothing is impossible. The whole of your world could be changed almost in the twinkling of an eye if all human beings recognized this truth and applied it in their actions, in their thoughts.
Once again, our time has gone. And I just have to say, bye-bye for now.